listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sounding culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
So this is Aaron from Sounding Out, and we have with us today Eric Ross, who's a theremin player. So, Eric, I know recently you performed at the Technology of Music Festival, I think in Binghamton, New York. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, yes, that was a nice gig that we did here in town. Lucky I happened to be in town. I just got back from L.A., I played out there. I did a solo concert at the new Disney Red Cat Center in downtown L.A., and that was really nice. Got out there and played at that festival out there, and then at Cal Arts, and I think that was it was really special because I know a lot of the musicians came out, and they said, well, you know, a lot of players out here are... they're all trying to copy each other. They're trying to sound like somebody else, but I came out and had that Wayland theremin and a MIDI guitar that I was playing with a car antenna. And so it was something really different for people, and I think something really they really appreciated.
Can you give me a little background about why you decided to learn the theremin?
I was really trying to find my own voice and my own identity in music, and so I went into electronic studios, and I started working in there with synthesizers and the classic tape studios, and after a little while in there working with the Moog analog synthesizer, I was looking through a catalog one day, and I saw, you know, I could order a theremin or buy one, so I did. I ordered a kit, and I had some engineers put it together for me, and started playing with it. Well, I quickly realized it was a very difficult instrument to play, but after a few years, I was able to make some music with it, and I used it on my first solo album in New York, an album called Songs for Synthesized Soprano, in which I used a soprano voice through a Moog synthesizer and then accompanied it with a lot of different instruments, including the theremin. And that album was really a breakthrough for me in terms of sales and reviews and airplay, and I know a lot of other musicians picked up on it. Pierre Boulez had a copy, John Cage, B.B. King, John McLaughlin, Miles Davis had a copy. So it was something that was, you know, really different at that time and really helped to get me across. That certainly, it enabled me to meet a lot of other musicians in the jazz and new music world in New York City. And one of the people I met was a theremin player, a guy named Yousef Yancey. And Yousef had played with Sun Ra and with Ornette Coleman and with Moo Hall Richard Abrams. He was a trumpeter and theremin player. So we got together and we did some theremin duets, and he suggested that I actually get in touch with Clara Rockmore, who was living in New York at that time. And so I did, and I called her up and told her what I was doing, and she said she knew. She heard about the album, and she invited me over, and we eventually became pretty good friends, and she would play for me sometimes. I would play for her. And, through her, I was able to meet Bob Moog, and then eventually in 1991, I met Professor Theremin himself and played for him and during the making of Steve Martin's film, Electronic Odyssey. So those people really kind of inspired me to continue on using the theremin as a voice in my own compositions. Yes.
So one of the questions, I mean, you're talking about, going in to learn about the Moog synthesizer, then coming out a theremin player, basically. What was that process of discovery like for you?
Well, I realized that it was theremin is a difficult instrument to play, but it had a unique kind of sound or a unique feel to it. Of course, there's no fretboard, there's no keyboard, so you really have to pick the notes out of the air. And then once you can do that, then you can begin to make some music on it. And having a background in electronic music, I was able to then take the theremin and put it through some effects units, guitar type of effects boxes, a fuzz pedal and a wah-wah and a digital delay and various other processing modules, and make that into an even newer sound. When I had the chance to meet Professor Theremin himself in 1991, I came into New York and I brought my theremin and I hooked it up and I played it for him through through a wah-wah pedal. And he had never heard that before. And then he wanted to try it himself, which he did, to a good effect. So it was kind of interesting. And then he also told me that he had planned to build a polyphonic theremin. But he didn't really live too long after that. He was 91 when I met him. And he died
wow.
the next year. Yeah. But he was still sharp, still alive. He was brought back for a movie made by Stephen Martin called Electronic Odyssey of Leon Theremin, which kind of depicts his life. So I had the chance to get into New York and meet him, and I did. And as I said, it was those three people, essentially, I would say, Clara Rockmore, Bob Moog, and Lev Theremin, that really inspired me to continue on with this instrument, as well as, as I say, use it in serious new compositions. Well, it's a very human instrument. I think the theremin, one thing about it is it's really ideally suited to kind of lead music into the future because it's a very human instrument played by the movements of the player's hands in the space around it. It's not digital. It's not programmable. You can't, set it up exactly as a computer type of sound or anything like that. It's very, very analog and very human sort of sound. So in that sense, and again, having no fretboard and no keyboard makes it, very distinct and different from most other instruments.
The next question I'd like to ask you is, what's your experience performing with the theremin mid-mic?
Well, it's always been very positive and very, I think, something that's been very attractive to a lot of different audiences. I think people are familiar with the sound of the theremin, but not everybody knows what it actually is. And then to actually see someone performing on the instrument, there's a very visual aspect to it as well. So, I like it, and for that respect. But I also think that it has a unique voice and a unique characteristic, and it really kind of can lead music into some new directions. And my setup at the moment is I've got the two theremins. One is pretty much straight. The other one is processed and MIDI'd. And then I have a MIDI guitar, and I'll use a concert grand piano and another keyboard synth. So I've got my own little ensemble that I'm able to perform on. And then I can add other players or other musicians, or usually I work with Mary's, my wife's video, and sometimes with dancers. But the theremin, to me, has always kind of been the lead instrument.
So when you're talking about performing with the theremin, you said that there was a lot of visual aspects involved with that process. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, the movements of the player's hands have to be very precise in the air to pick off the notes. And there's that aspect of it. And also with the MIDI program, one person said to me at the techno fair this weekend, he said it was really unusual and interesting for him to watch I had the theremin set on a drum sound, so I was actually playing the drums in the air. And he said, you know, he's used to seeing a drummer hit the drums, but then to hear the, you know, see somebody playing the drums out of the air like that was something unusual and different for him. So there's that, you know, audio and visual aspect of it too. I think that's one thing. And, you know, just the actual performing of a piece of music on the theremin, to watch someone pick the notes out of the air is kind of unique.
I would think it's almost like magic in some ways.
Well, sometimes people, people think it is. You know, you're pulling the notes out of the air if they don't understand how it, you know, how it works. But I've done the performances with multiple theremins too. Four, six. I think the biggest piece I did an overture for 14 theremins, and that was very interesting. I took the players and I spread them around this big auditorium and had them in the balcony and in the wings, and the piece was very nice. It was very beautiful, very meditative sort of music.
What was the experience of the other players during the overture?
Well, I'm sure everybody really loved it. It gave them a chance to play both unison parts with other players, and also with they all had little solos. So it really worked, but it had to be pretty ordered and pretty organized, because the multiple theremins. Sometimes they have problems with intonation and with tuning and with that many instruments trying to hear each other. But in this particular case, as I said, we were pretty organized and well rehearsed, so it came off really nicely. And I like to do things like that. There's lots of other instrumentalists that I like to work with. And the theremin blends well with most other instruments, so it's really nice. I just did a piece in California at Cal Arts, in fact, and one of the other lead players was a harp, and that was a really nice combination, theremin and harp.
So I'm going to change gears a little bit. Can you tell us a little about what it's like to listen to your own theremin performance while you're doing it, what that feels like for you?
Well, I have a set of goals and objectives that I try and hit for every performance. And among them, you know, I want to hit the central note in the mix that's going to energize that mix and move it on to another level. So for me to do that, I have to be very much in the moment that the music that I'm creating, the music. There's some parts that are going to be very fixed and are written out, and then there's other parts that are going to be improv and are going to be more spontaneous. And my job is to, as I say, hit that central note. So I've got to pre-hear the note before I hit it, and then go from there and always stay in that mix and in that moment. And if I can do that and I can hit those objectives, then I feel it's been a successful performance.
Okay, so what do you mean pre-hear? That's really interesting. How do you learn how to pre-hear? What is pre-hearing?
Well, it comes, I think, from certainly from experience and also from intuition, and it's being able to hear where the note is, where the center of the note is that I want to hit. And you know, a lot of times I can hear where it's going before it's going to get there. Other times, you know, I know the trend or the general direction that it's going to be in, so I can go with it or I can lead it. And it's really important on the theremin because you've got to hear, you know, got to pick the notes out of the air. So part of it is being able to hear exactly or pre-hear where that note is before you get there. And then when you get there, sometimes there's subtle adjustments that you might need to make. The attack, the release, the vibrato, the sustain of the note, all of those things you have to adjust in the moment, but be able to hear, as I said, kind of pre-hear where the note is going.
So So thinking about your body in this context, can you walk us through, you know, what sort of body parts you're activating while you're sort of playing a song in a theremin?
Well, the left hand is the volume, and the right hand is the pitch. They're both equally important. I have about a 5.5-octave range, and within that, you know, I can pick off any of those notes and then bring in the different type of effects. Really, it just depends on the movements of my two hands. The rest of the body should be really pretty much perfectly still or outside of the so-called magic circle where you're going to affect the pitch. And so I have to keep everybody away in about a 3 or 4 foot radius so that they're not triggering off the theremin. But then in that circle, that's where I move, and it's, you know, basically just the movements of my hands that is controlling the sound. Well, as I say, it's important that the player is really relaxed, because any tension will cause fatigue, and fatigue will cause mistakes. So it takes a real mental concentration and yet a very complete physical relaxation.
Yeah, how do you do that?
Seems like a paradox.
Yeah,
but it is in fact true. And I think it's something that all good musicians really aspire to. Something I know I learned when I was a young musician, when I first went to New York as a professional young player. One of the things that really impressed me, the great musicians that I saw, was that they were able to get that concentration from the very first note to the last. I mean, their mentally was, their focus was totally there. But they had a lot of endurance. And the only way that you can achieve that endurance is to just really physically relax. And, really concentrate on the relaxation of the whole playing mechanism. So it takes a while to learn. There were certain groups of muscles that I had that, you know, actually concentrate on mentally, focus on to make them relax. But, again, with enough experience and enough practice, I'm able to, you know, get to that performance state.
So what sort of drills and practice do you do to get there?
Well, there's all kinds. If I'm rehearsing to go on the road, if I'm going on the road, I'll rehearse really intensely, you know, for at least 6 weeks beforehand, maybe 6 days a week, 6 hours a week. I'll rehearse that much. But then there's other times when I'm on the road where I won't have an instrument, I won't have the possibility to set up and rehearse. And in those situations, usually what I do every day is run over my program mentally, so that I rehearse all my moves and what it is that I want to do and need to do, so that I can keep, you know, mentally focused that way. And
So you can do that just in your brain?
Yes. And indeed I have to, because I've been on the road sometimes for months at a time, and there'll be times, the only time that I'll get to play will be like, you know, in a concert or a sound check or something like that. So I've got to, you know, keep myself mentally that alert and run over the program every day that way. And it seems to work out, so that I don't really need to rehearse as much as I sometimes as I would like to, but I always like to be well rehearsed and well prepared. So
one of the things that you just brought up also that I was really interested in was you said that you construct a sort of magic circle around the theremin when you're playing it. Is this normal for theremin players to construct this sort of thing, or is this more of a personal philosophy for how the theremin works?
Well, no, it's just to keep from interfering with the sound, keep people back and away from it. No, because if they're closer than that, as I said, they'll trigger off the sounds. And so sometimes you get like a howl, you know, someone will walk by and you can get like a howling noise or something. So it's not so much that it's magical or mystical in that regard, in that it's just, you know, you don't want other people within that range where it's going to pick up the sound.
Yeah, there's an idea. The idea of a magic circle has been thrown around before in sort of academic literature on play. And people talk about it as a sort of safe space of learning where you almost anything is possible.
Right.
But then leaving it is a sort of space of society. And I was wondering if there was anything in that metaphor for you.
I hear what you're saying, and I'd never thought about it in exactly those terms, but it is. I think you do need certainly to perform on the theremin, you do need that sort of physical space, and I think people need that sort of space too in their lives and in their work. When I sometimes have been on the road in a big city and you'd be packed in a subway or in a bus or in a crowded street or something, you think you really sometimes can't be free in what you want to do or what you want to think or how you want to be, but you would like, I know I always like to get to places where it's kind of quiet and it's contemplative and not necessarily deserted, devoid of people or anything, but just that you have a certain space that you can feel comfortable in. And that could be, it could be a big area, it could be a small area, but I think everybody has to have at least some sort of personal space like that.
So when we were talking earlier, you've been talking about so many sort of contradictions of theremin playing, right? Like you need focus, or you need relaxation. And I know when we had spoken earlier, you had spoken about the sort of balance of the musician between the sort of Apollonian and Dionysian aspects of play,
right.
Meaning Apollonian sort of controlled, structured understanding, and Dionysian being sort of chaotic, indulgent
right.
moments of play. Can you talk
right.
a little more about that?
Right. Well, I think some of the best music strikes a balance between those two aspects. And it's something that I think in my own compositions I've kind of done it maybe unconsciously for a number of years, in that there are certain sections that I of a composition which will be very structured and very written out and very precise, and they're always the same way. And then there's other parts that are very open and improvisational and can allow for any kind of development whatsoever to take place. So, in some compositions, maybe there'd be more of the fixed writing part, and others would be more improvisational parts. But I think, for me, looking back, the best compositions were ones that kind of struck a balance between that kind of cool, classical, organized restraint and the kind of wild, improvisational, unexpected, dramatic aspects of music as well. It's become a goal, but I think I kind of discovered it almost inadvertently, and as looking back on it, that balance seems to be something that really is intriguing and to me really, really kind of works the best.
So how does this come out in your performance when you're controlling your hands and you're focusing and relaxing?
Right. Trying to relax. Now that's a contradiction. You can't try to relax. Just have to relax. But what am I thinking? Well, I have a series of goals and a series of objectives that I'm trying to hit. And among them, try and hit the central note of it's going to energize the mix. I want to play something that I've never heard before. I want to try and use all my sounds and all my colors and all the emotions of the possibility, emotional possibilities of the instrument to bring that music to a higher level, so a level of where it becomes light and it has that kind of capacity to please. And so there's some of the objectives that I want to hit in performance, and those are some of the things that are going through my mind. Although at this point in my career or my performance experiences, they're almost subconscious. Although I will review that list very carefully, almost like a pilot, before he takes off,
mm-hmm.
so that I know exactly what it is, I continue to want to do. I try and play as if it's the last time that maybe I'll ever play. So I really want to do it in every performance. That's why I said, well, is there any time when it's not there? I said, no, because I never know when it's going to be the last time. Nobody does, right? So you want to play it in the best way that you possibly can and say, this is it. And then I think about, you know, sometimes the other musicians that I've worked with who are no longer around are able to do it. And, you know, those people who inspired me, like Clara Rockmore and Bob Moog and Lev Theremin, they're, you know, those people are gone now. But, you know, their influence still kind of remains. And so those are some of the objectives that I'm trying to hit.
So what sort of things do you find that the theremin is good at emoting as a musician that maybe a guitar isn't so good at emoting, or a piano isn't so good at emoting? Like, what sort of feelings can you encounter from it?
Yeah, I think every instrument has its own voice and its own you know, kind of idiomatic structures that it works best with. The theremin being a monophonic instrument, I think the closest to me that it, in the upper range, it sounds like a human voice. In the middle range, it can sound like a wind instrument, and then the lower range, it can sound like a cello. It can do those kind of things, although it's, you know, it's monophonic. I think that, you know, while maybe it's not a transliteral sort of music triggers maybe deep emotions, even though they may be inarticulate verbally, I think that theremin, because of its range, it has the ability to, you know, be a very expressive sort of instrument. It has that human sort of quality. It's kind of like a voice, but yet it's not. It's electronic. So that's something that I think it does very well. A piano, on the other hand, piano is, you know, is a great literature, and it has a very distinctive sort of sound. But in the 20th century, it became more of a percussive instrument, and people like John Cage were playing on the inside of the piano. So, you know, all these instruments are expanded. The electric guitar is probably the other instrument besides the synthesizer that's really invented in the 20th century, although the guitar has been around for a long time. But the electrification of the guitar is different, and the midification of the guitar is even more different. Something that you know, I got into about 20 years ago as well, the MIDI guitar, and I've been working with that for a long time. And that, again, you know, is another type of trigger, and you can get another type of sound happening, and visually it's different. And the guitar and the theremin complement each other pretty well. So,
yeah, I guess that would make sense, because you said, you know, the theremin is the range of the voice, and guitar is often accompanied by voice in some ways. So
sure.
So what do you think is usually going through the heads of people when they hear you play for the first time, or people who have maybe never heard a theremin before?
Well, it's hard to say. I think, you know, my experience has been some people like it a lot. Some people like it but don't know what was going on, and maybe some people won't like it at all, depending on their background. I think it's always best, or it's oftentimes best, if I can do a little educational component before I do the concert. I know at Cal Arts I had the chance to do a lecture on the theremin and my involvement with it for about an hour lecture, and then worked with the students to show them one of my pieces. And I've also done it at the colleges and universities and art centers and museums. And I think that gives people an enrichment and an understanding of it, just like we've been talking here. You know, you get a little bit of a background of the instrument and what the player is trying to do. It makes it more rewarding rather than if you just come in and sit down and listen to a new music concert. Especially, I think, people who have not heard much or if any new music, they don't know. As we were talking before, they don't maybe know the music of guys like Cage and Varese and Boulez and Stockhausen and Luning and Ussachevsky and Zanakis and Sun Ra and Ornette and Mulhall Richard Abrams and John McLaughlin and the late Coltrane of Ascension period. So Sonny Sherrock, one of all those guys. If they don't have any kind of a background in that, then it might be something totally different for them, something totally new. And some people like that. Other people don't like that. Other people might feel threatened or angered or whatever. Who knows? They, you know, I don't know. But that's not my concern. My concern, as I said, is to try and do the music the best way that I can and play it as best as I can. And if I do that, then I feel I've done my job. And sometimes people will come up to me and they'll tell me something about the concert, their impressions, whatever, and that's nice, but maybe it doesn't tell me anything at all about the music. It just tells me something about them.
Right.
But overall, I have to say the reaction through the years has been very positive and very favorable, especially other musicians and especially a lot of the critics. The critical reviews of my stuff through the years has really been always very positive. And, you know, even people who don't understand it, maybe don't like it, don't know what it is, they still, you know, manage to find something to say, well, you know, it's something different, or, you know, it's well made, it's put together, you know, in a certain organizational, compositional, with a certain amount of skill, or the playing is a certain level of virtuosity. And so those sorts of things. And the general public, too. But again, as I said, I think the educational aspect and that outreach is really important for serious new music, as it is with any kind of serious new art, poetry or painting or sculpture or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting that an educational component is kind of involved. Can you tell me some differences you've observed in reactions from people between audiences who have received the sort of theremin education beforehand and audiences who maybe haven't?
Well, I know is that, you know, when I was out in L.A., last month, and this goes for many years. I did the program out there, and you know, some people said to me, "Well, at last, some real music in LA, or this is something really, you know, unique and something different." I know a couple of the keyboard players were saying to me, "This is really great that you come out and do something different," because a lot of the keyboard players out here, a lot of the musicians out here, they're all copying each other, and you know, I got this kind of wailing theremin and play the guitar with a car antenna or whatever. And so I'm not trying, and I never have been tried to catch a trend or be a pop sort of musician in that sort of way. I always kind of felt that it's not the job of the composer to be more popular. It's the job of the audience to be more artistic. So. on the other hand, as I say, I just try and do what I do the best way I can. And, you know, people are open and they're willing to listen. They generally appreciate it. I did a concert in Heidelberg, Germany. There was a professor of music there at the university taught. And he said he spent the first half of my concert trying to listen and trying to understand, and he didn't get it. And he said then he spent the second half of the concert just listening, and he said, and then he got it. So...
Nice.
I think, you know, it takes a certain type of openness. Anytime that we're doing something new, and in my music, I've always tried to do something that's new and something that's different. And I think the way that I went about doing that is to try and deal with the four basic elements of music. That is harmony, melody, rhythm, and timbre. Melody is, you know, everybody knows what melody is, but if you start taking those melodies, and I early on, one of the things that I really got fascinated with was the 12-tone system. This is evolved by Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern. And I would take those 12-tone melodies and those 12-tone processes, inversion, retrograde inversion, and use them in different ways, in different ideas, in different contexts. So the melodies become different. The harmony, I took a lot of the harmonies from jazz harmonies where they use extended chords, 9s, 11, 13, flat 5, sharp 5. And so the harmonies become unusual, and they're not the usual major or minor triads. Rhythm, like a lot of different rhythms, one of the finales of a piece that I've written is in 15/8 time. So that's a kind of unusual time signature. And then others, you know, do like 9/8, 7/4, or whatever, as well as a more usual time signature. But, you know, always a little bit of different rhythmical things going on. And then timbre, that's instrumental color. Well, the theremin has a very unique timbre and instrumental color, and so do all the synthesizers and many other instruments. And I, you know, instructed a player that are playing traditional instruments to use them in non-traditional ways. if they're a violin player, maybe bow behind the bridge or use different kinds of pizzicatos or different effects. So you start changing all of those elements of music, and then you maybe can come up with something that's really new. And, you know, in a new structure or a new composition. But again, you know, I think it takes some education and some talking and some explanation about the music for people to be able to appreciate it at first listen.
So I've listened to a good deal of 12-tone music when I was younger, taking music classes, and I never really enjoyed it. But I wouldn't necessarily think of the theremin in the context of 12-tone music. You said that there's something very distinctive to compare the melody that you construct in the theremin to the melodies that the composers have constructed in the history of 12-tone music. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, the 12-tone system, that's just one of the methods or one of the techniques, but it treats all 12 notes of the scale as equal. There's no home or key bass. No familiar territory that the ear will come back to. It's constantly shifting and constantly changing. And as that's evolved, that system has evolved over time. It's developed so that it encompasses all the other aspects of it, too, so that you can serialize the rhythm and the harmony as well. So if you maybe take that type of a melody and then you put it in with a more traditional sort of jazz sort of harmony or a different type of rhythm with it, then again, you know, you're getting something that's a little bit of a change, and it can be very expressive and very unique sounding. And again, you'll avoid certain kind of cliches and certain kind of traditional sort of aspects of music. It is new territory, still.
So another question I had is, you know, we don't see theremins everywhere. We don't hear theremins everywhere. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think for many years there were very few instruments, or really good instruments. And so because there wasn't very many instruments, there weren't very many players. And it was only really in the 90s that the instrument Bob Moog started making them, and a few other manufacturers started making the instruments again. And then it was around then, the 80s and the late 80s and the 90s, that the theremin began a revival. And there's hundreds of players worldwide today, and using it in all different kinds of music, everything from classical to pop to rock to gospel to blues and jazz. It is not as popular. The instruments were one problem, but the other problem is it's a difficult instrument to play well. It takes a lot of practice and a lot of commitment, and there's no fretboard, no keyboard, so there's no easy reference to it. But with Perkin, there's a number of good players out there today. I think you're hearing it more and more in different kinds of music, and it'll turn up in unexpected places as well. My own interest in it will continue on. I used it in all my major compositions in the last couple of decades, and I will continue to do so. As I said, I think it's a very human instrument. It's played by the movements of the player's hands and the space over it, and I think it's ideally suited to lead music into the future.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? I think it's really interesting that you keep on coming back to this human element in this theremin.
Well, as I say, it's not digital, it's not programmable, it's not something that is even infinitely repeatable. It's something that the instrument will change according to the room and the space and the temperature of the room. And so you've got to approach it and make subtle adjustments to it every time that you play it. And I think it's very honest, too, because every time you come to it, it'll tell you exactly who you are and what you've done and where you've been and those sort of things as well. So for those reasons, and as I say, it's the fact that it's not programmable, it makes it a very human electronic instrument.
So, what do you think you bring up technology, and like I know you've worked with MIDI, and you've even interfaced your theremin with that.
Right.
So is the theremin just like the human trick in your bag, or do you try and bring a little of this humanness into other instruments that might not so readily emote these sort of human sensibilities?
Well, I think that the compositional sensibility and the performance sensibility is really important to music. I know I've seen and heard some music that's just performed and composed on laptops, and it really seems kind of lifeless in a way. I think that human element, that human interaction with it is something that's really important, and I think that people ultimately will relate to. But, you know, that's just kind of my own feeling on it. I try and do that, keep that element in it in all the music, because otherwise it becomes sterile. And one of the things I've always thought of is that emotion, feeling without technique is inarticulate. But technique without emotion is just empty display. So the ideal is to have that kind of balance between, you know, the technological end of it, but also to keep the human and the human element central.
All right. Well, I really enjoyed having this conversation with you. Is there anything that you didn't feel like you got to really talk about that you would like to talk about now that you have the space?
Well, I'd like to say that I've been kind of lucky in my career to have met and performed with many great musicians. And I tried to learn something from all of them about their approach to music. And yet at the same time, I knew kind of early on what I wanted to do was to find my own voice and my own identity in music. And I've been lucky in the sense that I did find a theremin, and I found some people who were supportive and kind of pointed the way to for me to a way that, you know, how I could proceed and what I wanted to do. So in that respect, I feel I've been lucky, and I try and keep on doing it. You know, one of the other things I'd like to say is that through the years, I've also used my wife, Mary Ross's, videos in my performances. She's a video artist, and she does video synthesis. And we've done a lot of these multimedia performances, and we'll continue to do those and work with that aspect of it as well.
What do you think the relationship between, you know, sound, performance, and media is?
Well, for me, working with her videos is, I imagine, as another line in the score. And I hear it and see it as kind of color and as forms and as shape and as energy and movement. And in the improvisational sections of pieces, I'm able to work with that and to kind of play with the different colors. And there's a kind of synergy, but I was going to say almost a synesthesia in some aspects of it, because I know I can play in certain colors and it reflects what's happening in the video and in the room and the lighting plot and that sort of thing too. So that's another interesting aspect that I'm planning to continue on with. And also another thing that I'm really looking forward to doing in the next 5 years or so is working with more musicians and more great players. I've had the chance to do that through the years and recently with a number of really great players. So, and different instruments and different combinations. So that's another thing that I'm looking forward to. So I plan to continue to do as long as I can do it and in the best way that I can.
One more question, because you brought it up. Synesthesia, is that intuitive, or
I worked early on with a fellow who invented a kind of a color organ, and we settled on like a 12-note scale. And I forget how we had worked it out. All I remember now was that the color red was the key of E. And I think the color purple or blue was B, and C was yellow. And so we worked with that organ quite a while, and it was pretty interesting how that actually triggered off those different types of... and we had based it on a color organ that was devised by Scriabin, who was a Russian composer in the early 20th century. And he had studied, I think he studied with Rimsky-Korsakov, and Rimsky had a color scheme also for different keys.
Mm.
So that was kind of interesting. And then, you know, we got working through years with the video, and it just seemed like there were certain keys that just kind of naturally fell into different colors. And, you know, I think it's different from one person to another, but there's other parts of it that, you know, some people seem to agree on. So there's also a synergy between the video and the audio when we work together, and the two parts become sometimes greater than just two parts. They become a third thing, and that's also been very interesting. So we'll continue on working with that. So, Aaron, thanks so much for your help and your time.
No, thank you. This is terrific. Cool. I really appreciate it, Eric. It's a pleasure having you talk to everybody at Sounding Out about the theremin and your experience with it, and I look forward to listening in to your future stuff.